Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. I personally look at each comment and will give you a shout out to each of you in our following episodes. It means a lot to hear from you. Our guest today is Ted McKenna, and we speak with him about his latest bestseller, which he co-authored with Matt Dixon, The Jolt Effect.
What we saw happening here is more of an emotional story going on with buyers, and it speaks to indecision itself. You know, the nature of indecision we see on a secular rise over time. If you dig into what's driving indecision, a lot of it has to do with the amount of options available to buyers and the amount of information that they feel like they have to go and learn, and the transformative sort of positioning that so many supplier organizations have put out there as a way to differentiate themselves also creates thorny issues that the buyer now has to navigate in terms of the implementation side of things. So there's a bunch of reasons that it's gotten scarier, really, for a buyer to engage in this and lonelier in many respects, which I can explain in a bit. But what you see in these conversations is just a lot of emotion, way more than you'd expect in a B2B setting. It's kind of dripping.
Ted McKenna is one of the world's leading experts in sales, business development, and customer experience, and a co-author of the best-selling book, The Jolt Effect: How High Performers Overcome Customer Indecision. His research frequently appears in the pages of Harvard Business Review, and he is a founding partner of DCM Insights, a boutique consultancy focused on using data and research-backed frameworks to help companies attract, retain, and grow their customers. Ted is an expert in analyzing behaviors of customers, door sellers, frontline sales and service agents, leaders, and board members, and applying analytics in various forms of content, products, and services. At Tether, Ted worked on mining unstructured conversational data using advanced data science and leading AI/ML tools to build models, scores, and behavioral frameworks, of which the most well-known model is the Tether Effort Index. Previous roles called for deploying syndicated research methods to mine more structured sources such as surveys, diagnostics, demographics, and jobs data. Now, on to this insightful episode with Ted McKenna. Ted, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm really excited to have you here and talk about this fascinating book that you have written. And let's take it from the top. Tell us a bit about the work you are doing and we'll dive right in.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit. So the book is called The Jolt Effect. It's about a customer and buyer indecision. And I co-wrote it with Matt Dixon, who your audience might know from the Challenger Sale, the Challenger Customer, Effortless Experience. Matt and I go way back as researchers to CEB, or Corporate Executive Board, which is now part of Gartner. So that's kind of my background as a researcher in the sales customer experience space in general. And 3-4 years ago, we were working for a company called Tether, which is a machine learning conversation intelligence type company. So they try to bring meaning to exchanges between customer and seller or customer service agents, depending upon the context of it. And we engaged in this big, huge study of sales. In total, we ended up collecting about 2.5 million sales conversations for this study. Part of the reason we were able to do it at such a large scale, especially in B2B sales at the time, was because we started this kind of right at the beginning of COVID, of the pandemic. that for everyone around the globe was a nightmare and horrible in general for society, but for us as researchers, represented this pretty interesting opportunity because overnight, conversations that used to happen out of our purview, you know, in customers' offices, coffee shops around the world, were happening on Zoom and Teams and all sorts of different web platforms that we could take and record and try to understand more kind of at scale. Now, for us, again, as researchers, this was a slightly newer thing for us. By then, we had been working at Tether for a couple of years and had really come to appreciate the power of unstructured data. And especially the power of conversational data. So the simplest way to think about this is that conversation is a lot richer because there's two sides to the conversation, quite obviously, right? But for a researcher, you can study both the seller and the buyer, but also the interchange in between. So I can understand and measure the effect that happens in sort of a call and response way, right? So seller uses one way to position value. Buyer responds in a certain way. Buyer says, I'm frustrated five different times in a conversation. Does that intensify the situation? We can measure all these things at scale, and it becomes very quite powerful, especially as you start to measure that across, in our case, millions of conversations. So, you know, again, different method for us. You know, we're used to studying structured data. You know, going back to our days at Challenger, and you know, probably the biggest study ever done in sales was spin selling, which was also survey based. And surveys have their place, right? They provide predictable outputs. You can sort of understand the structured fields you're getting back, but they have limitations too. You know, they're limited to the questions you think to ask when you go to deploy the survey. There's bias associated with the responses. Often, you know, certain people won't respond. And they're kind of very onerous to deploy. You know, they take a long time. They take a big team. It's, you know, there's downsides to it. So there was both upside benefit from the potential of studying unstructured audio and unstructured text, which has its challenges too, which we can get into, but also the curiosity about what is the potential difference we can get from this unstructured data relative to our past methods. So I don't know how detailed you want me to get into the study itself, but the study ended up kind of going down this path of looking at losses and trying to understand, you know, what's going on there in situations, especially where you would have expected to see a win, you know, where the seller was doing all the things you would have hoped for, buyer seemed pretty excited, and yet got stuck and they were still losing. That for us caught our attention, and that's kind of where the study ended up going.
So, we can go deeper because this is super interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Very rarely do we talk of this kind of structured, unstructured research. Mm-hmm. Most books are written out of experiences that sales practitioners have had, and they write using case studies of their own work and so on. So this is a very different thing. Mm-hmm. One quick question is that how did you sort of correlate to the final outcome? Because you were, if I am understanding incorrectly, these are millions of minutes of recording done across hundreds of organizations, perhaps. Yeah. And now you are trying to sort of find the common threads or uncommon threads and so on.
Yeah.
How were you able to actually connect it to, okay, this one actually ended in a sale and this didn't?
Yeah, well, the first step is actually years of work to classify the data. So, and this is, you know, what all AI models out there now are dependent upon as well, is classifying events that happen in the conversation. You know, seller says this, that means that they are using this type of technique. Buyer says this, you can categorize that as decision uncertainty or confusion. And those things are different and articulated differently. But also each one of those separate things is articulated in what could be thousands of different ways. And so you have to teach the machine to recognize all the different variants of those different emotions And then understand, as I mentioned earlier, the interplay and the exchange, and understand what happens when, you know, the value of the of a pitch is positioned, and the seller or the buyer responds in muted ways versus very excited ways, and what's the difference, and how do you understand that? So, years of work to train the machine to recognize all of those different events in the conversation, and then we built a predictive model. Using outcomes basically as did that sale end up closing or not. So you collect that, you know, from CRM systems. And then we also collected performance data from participating organizations, which allowed us to cross-reference and test and validate, hey, this is coming back with things that also show high performers doing better or more frequently. Mm-hmm. But we used the math essentially to tell us, in total, our model had 8,000 plus variables. So that's lots of individual things that somebody could do, but also sequenced events matter quite a bit. You know, this thing happened before this thing or the reverse. And so you end up getting tons and tons of variables. We correlate that against those outcomes, like did that sale close or not, which tells us out of all those 8,000 things, what are the things that ended up mattering most? Now, there's still complexity in analysis that comes out of it. As you might expect, the output of that model is quite large, to say the least. I mean, it is a giant data set. We actually had to Tether has this brilliant data scientist named Tom Shepard, who's built this proprietary math solver that's necessary because the type of math you're running here would break most conventional software systems, statistical software systems. So they have an advantage there with their ability to crunch that type of data, but the output is still very complex on the back end. You know, so it was months of work for Matt and I to weed through it all and try to make sense of it. And some of it is grouping things together. You know, hey, when these things happen, they're pretty similar to these other things. Let's call that proactive guidance. Let's call that advocacy. So now we're terming those things to try to make sense for it as people look to try to take meaning from it and understand it. So that's a lot of work as well. There's also, you know, not to get too into the weeds, but there's a whole lot of what I'd call kind of conditional analysis. You know, hey, what happens in these situations versus what happens in those types of situations? You know, when this thing's high, what happens? When that thing's high, what's different? And trying to tease that apart. So it was a lot of work, but you know, that's one of the interesting things about unstructured data is it's this ocean of information, which is very powerful and very enticing, but it's also an ocean of information that you have to go and then try to make sense of. So it brings its own challenges.
So Ted, one question. Going in, did you know who were the high performers, or was it something that emerged as you went through the study?
Most of the analysis and most of the bar charts, even in the book, as you look at it, are about win rate. So where do we see people winning at a higher clip than others? But the predictive model was quite literally, what's the biggest lift in sales performance on a relative basis, given different factors? You know, if you were to independently measure the effect of this thing versus that thing, what's the lift in the model? So expectation setting, as one example, is a skill in the book that we found to be the most powerful out of all the skills that had the biggest lift. Now, when we go to describe for the average reader what that means, it's easier to interpret that as what's the actual absolute lift in win rate, even though technically under the covers, we're also looking at the lift in the actual model that we deployed.
So I'm surmising from what you told me till now that at the end, when you distill those four key behaviors, mm-hmm. that resulted in this lift, that resulted in the better performance, which is significant. I mean, it's like a lot, right? Were the people who are practicing it doing it quite intuitively on their own? I mean, or was there something else sort of influencing them to do that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, we typically forever we've always had a sort of slight bias on our own to study what we call lead steers. So we like to study high performers and draw inspiration from that. So if you look at the top 20% performers, what are they doing differently than their peers? Now, we also want to, of course, understand what's going on with buyers such that we can interpret and understand why are they doing something different. But it's been true for a long time that high performers are one of the first groups to figure out that there are shifts happening with buyers, and that requires us to change how we might think about engaging with them. So that's a one amongst other reasons why we find it to be most interesting to study what those folks are doing and contrast it against others. And so that's kind of what we try to zero in on is, you know, what are those individuals doing differently? Not the top 1% or the top 5%, because you might not be able to replicate that. Right, those people might just be doing things that are innately amazing and you can't actually teach other people to do it. But if you look at a broad enough cross section, top 20% we find to be the most reliable, they've just figured something out, right? And it's our job to kind of decode and demystify what it is that they are doing, such that we can help others to emulate that. And so that's kind of where we typically focus in on our research.
Right. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about the buyer having morphed into a different kind of buyer than they were when your first book was written, right?
Yep.
So what did you, I mean, because you were obviously listening to the other side as well. Mm-hmm. You were analyzing what the buyers were saying as well.
Yep.
What kind of shifts do you see in the buyer's approach to the selling process?
Yeah, I mean, there've been, for those in your audience that are familiar with the Challenger sale and some of the work that we did, I was a researcher on those teams. Matt was a co-author of it. So going back to, late 2008, 2009 into the early 2010s, we wrote a lot about the shift in purchasing due to highly informed buyers. You know, the internet became a thing and they can go and do research on their own. The second big shift that we started to understand was the consensus based decision making that we saw larger organizations making. So the group dynamics got to be a bigger deal, you know, more and more people involved in the decision. And now a seller has to navigate this complex web of individuals inside the organization. And I think those things still remain a challenge for many organizations. So nothing has changed on that front. What we saw happening here is more of an emotional story going on with buyers, and it speaks to indecision itself. You know, the nature of indecision we see on a secular rise over time. If you dig into what's driving indecision, a lot of it has to do with the amount of options available to buyers and the amount of information that they feel like they have to go and learn, and the transformative sort of positioning that so many supply organizations have put out there as a way to differentiate themselves. Also creates thorny issues that the buyer now has to navigate in terms of the implementation side of things. So there's a bunch of reasons that it's gotten scarier, really, for a buyer to engage in this and lonelier in many respects, which I can explain in a bit. But what you see in these conversations is just a lot of emotion, way more than you'd expect in a B2B setting. It's kind of dripping there if you look for it. It's somewhat underneath the surface, you know, so it's not always explicit in their articulation, but often implied, or, you know, the machine can pick up on things that humans might not with their own ears, right? That was one of the powerful things of using AI and machine learning, you know, for this. But lots of emotion about, you know, I'm not really so sure about where I should go here, and I want this, I need this, but what if this happens, and what if that happens, and what if this happens, and sort of grapple with all the implications of if I were to go down this path.
Yeah, I think the last part where you're talking about taking the risk off the table, or I think it's very true, because as I also talk to buyers, one of the things that I hear is, see, for the sales guy, his deal closes when I've signed in and given him the money. For me, it only begins because now I have to go and justify the purchase to get the outcome that I'm supposed to get.
Yeah, and I think that is certainly true, right? And that has been true for a while. In our Challenger days, we wrote about the pain of change and what the buyer is starting to think through about, God, you know, change is hard and change is annoying and it's going to be, I'd rather not change. And that's a hurdle you have to overcome. But there's also, you know, personal risk that this person is taking on. There's even over and above my concern about the change, there's also just the nature of, like, I'm going to choose one path and I feel like I'm going to immediately regret the fact that I chose that path instead of this one, right? You know, there's dynamics like who among us has not been oversold in the past or overpurchased in the past. And nobody wants to be the fool who has done that too. So there's a whole concoction of emotions that are happening at that point. One of which, of course, certainly is, yeah, this is going to be the next 2 years of my life, you know, and a lot of things could go wrong. And when those things go wrong, I could get blamed, and that's what I want to avoid.
Hmm. Right. Wonderful. Is there anything else about the research you'd like to touch upon, which I'm not probing at this point?
No, I think that's most of kind of the journey, if you will. For us, it was really powerful to be able to mine, you know, again, what's going on at the, you know, the point that is kind of the pointy end of the spear, if you will. It's right where at the place where we're observing directly what's going on. That's another thing I guess I should have mentioned, a difference between surveys and conversation is that surveys, you're naturally talking about things that happened in the past and asking people to recall into their best recollection, how are they feeling at that point or what do they do. With conversation, we're going observing directly what happens. And consequently, the takeaways we have, the skills that we're pointing to, can get very tactical in nature. You know, we're talking like quite literally, what might you say or what might this sound like? And so the takeaways are very, very powerful.
What was your writing process? So you have this all this data and this data scientist in Tether is helping you sort of writing the program, getting it through analysis. You are getting tons of output. Mm-hmm. You're going through it. So what did you do? I mean, once you out this data, what was your process?
Yeah, so there's a research phase where we're collecting data, we're then crunching data, then we're trying to interpret and analyze data. And, you know, all of that can take, I think in total, that probably took, you know, 6 to 9 months, you know, just for those pieces themselves. And then we're trying to make sense of, okay, what does this help us understand about what's going on out there in the market? So we paired this with a whole bunch of interviews as well, you know, of salespeople, sales leaders, even some buyers too, to try to understand, you know, what are we seeing here and how does this make sense and how does this contrast with what people are seeing out in market? And then, yeah, we go to put pen to paper, you know, which is, now there's an interim phase where we go to a publisher and ask them, hey, would you have interest in us going and writing something like this? And we were fortunate enough with a portfolio, which is part of Penguin Random House, that they were excited about that. So got that all underway. And then I'd say the writing process itself, I want to say, you know, we started in, I don't know, probably like May or June and finished around like January 1st. So it's a 6 month endeavor, essentially. Lots of drafts, you know, lots of spilled ink, if you will, cutting room floor material for sure. But that's part of our process. You know, we are iterative in nature and we try to sort of turn the screws as best we can. What's the real problem here? What are we really trying to say? How do we get to that argument? And Matt Dixon is, you know, a wizard on narrative and, you know, one of the best in the world at that. So, I was quite fortunate to be able to work with him.
So what was it that did you structure? Okay, this is going to be the, I mean, I will come to the question of how did you arrive at Jolt and what were the other acronyms you had before that?
That's, you know, we don't share those types of details. That's too much cutting room floor material. Yeah, it's funny you asked that. We had, you know, and probably an embarrassing number of different iterations of what became Jolt. Even within Jolt, there's a couple of different phrases that we had considered for like the J or the O, the L. Mm. I mean, I can't tell you different how many different versions of the L we had. But yeah, you know, just lots of back and forth, lots of hard thought.
Right. And what was the actual writing? Were you like writing separate chapters, or were you sort of collaborating on all the chapters together?
Yeah. I mean, so Matt took the lead on the first half of the book, and I wrote a lot of the second half of the book to oversimplify. Most of the time he was doing the front half of the book. I was still making sure we had all the data correct, making sure that we were working with the team to get all the calculations correct. And especially as the graphs, you know, that's the other thing is you, you know, you can draw a conclusion, but then how do you visually best depict this? You know, is this better for a bar chart, or is this better depicted in a visual that we're going to put together to try to, you know, sort of depict what might be happening here?
Tell me about, I mean, obviously, one of the biggest or possibly the point that you're trying to address here is the inaction in a sales process or the buying process, whichever you look at it. And that is the core that you are trying to sort of address. Was this a natural kind of outcome of the research, or is indecision the core problem that sales is facing today?
Yeah, well, I might. So inaction, yes, but really it's no decision. So all the situations in which it feels like the buyer is inclined to purchase, but then decides to do nothing at all. And end in no decision. So we're not losing to a named competitor, but rather the buyer stalling out and deciding they're not going to do it. That became the main focus of the study, largely because we did see all these instances and ended up being about 40 to 60% of no decision, or sorry, of losses were due to no decision, not named competitor. That was a bigger, much bigger number than we had expected. So we ended up zeroing in quite a bit on those. And when you tease that apart, some of that has to do with their preference for what they're doing today, you know, their preference for their status quo. And, you know, that's an important element of any sale. It's trying to overcome their indifference to the problem you're trying to solve or to you as the preferred supplier. But there was a second problem that we didn't fully appreciate and became the main focus of the study, which was indecision due to fear of failure. You know, we saw all these instances in the study of the buyer being very excited to purchase, feeling like there was a clear need, you know, had an intent to purchase, had even potentially selected that vendor. So if they bought from anyone, they were going to buy from that vendor, and yet still, and the seller was doing all the things you would hope for. You know, they're creating urgency, creating, you know, really creating this burning platform for change, driving home that need, and yet still got stuck. And so that's that indecision. And when you dig into the psychology of it all, much of it has to do with this fear of failure. And so we talk in the book about psychological concepts that people much smarter than us have tested for years, you know, in psychology and behavioral economics, called omission bias and the effect it has. Now, this has been known for a while in psychology circles, but nobody had really grappled with what this meant for buyer-seller exchange. And it does end up upending quite a bit of conventional wisdom about how we should be engaging buyers.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
The problem is most sellers in that situation make it worse, not better, because they interpret that hesitation. They interpret those cold feet as a problem with persuasion and motivation. I must not have persuaded them enough. They must not want it enough. They're saying they do. But if they did want it enough, surely these concerns they have about conditions ought not be a problem. Like surely we would have continued momentum. Momentum must be dying because they don't want it enough. And so because of that, I go back to relitigate the case for change.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
What the study ended up looking into is, you know, what was the biggest swing variable in the model, the biggest swing difference we saw between high and average performers was in those situations that we ended up calling cold feet moments, where it felt like buyer was really excited and then they start to go dark, they start to backtrack, they start to not show up for calls or not answer emails. In those situations, we found high performers acting quite differently. And if you think about a typical decision process, you know, we've got to get the buyer to believe that change is necessary. that's sort of an agreement on vision, and then we got to get them to transact on it. There's a purchase decision with a, you know, DocuSign, and they're transacting. And of course, lots of things can go wrong in late stages, even after the buyer agrees in concept that this is something we should do as an organization, that this is right for us and that we're ready to move forward. A whole bunch of things can go wrong. You know, terms have to be considered, conditions are weighed, all these things, and lots of deals die at that point. The problem is most sellers in that situation make it worse, not better, because they interpret that hesitation. They interpret those cold feet as a problem with persuasion and motivation. I must not have persuaded them enough. They must not want it enough. They're saying they do, but if they did want it enough, surely these concerns they have about conditions ought not be a problem. Like surely we would have continued momentum. Momentum must be dying because they don't want it enough. And so because of that, I go back to relitigate the case for change. I try to drown them in, here's all the reasons why you should change. And they can take on different forms, but all of them are sort of a what we'd call a FOMO appeal. You're trying to appeal to their fear that they're going to miss out. You're going to miss out on the upside gain, or you're going to miss out on trying to outcompete your competitors or solving this problem. It's all about missing out. And so, again, that can take a couple different forms. So I can paint a really rosy picture about all the benefits you're going to get. I can paint a very dark picture about all the bad things that will happen if you don't change. Or I can try to throw that 10% discount at you to try to get you over the line. Any one of those three things, though, what we found is that they actually backfire. They make things worse, not better. The seller would be better off doing nothing at all at that moment when they get those cold feet. So that's one of the first best lessons from the study is in those situations when the buyer gets cold feet, don't throw more fear on top of it. You're taking an already terrified buyer and you're throwing more fear on top of that. And so the answer in terms of how to overcome this is to address not their FOMO, that's the fear of missing out, but rather their FOMU, that's the fear of messing up. And this speaks to that omission bias, you know, that Kahneman and Tversky and, again, tons of psychologists and behavioral economists have written about. Omission bias, to simplify it for your audience, is omission bias in general is something we're all quite familiar with because it's something that, you know, the biggest part of this that we're most familiar with is the error of omission, which is I didn't do something and as a consequence, I missed out. Right. This happens personally, like I didn't go to the party. I missed out. I now have some regret. Or your friend invested in crypto and you didn't. And now they own a private island and you don't. And so you're jealous. Like I didn't do something and I missed out. The error of commission, though, is something that a lot of people don't know about. And that plays a big role here. The error of commission is I did do something. It went horribly wrong and I got blamed. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, in the context of purchasing, imagine that. Right. I made a decision. It backfired for the whole organization. Everyone hates it. Who gets blamed? The person who made the decision, right? Now I look like an idiot. I'm exposed. I've lost political clout. All sorts of things can happen, potentially even get fired if you spend a bunch of money and this thing goes wrong. That's an error of commission. And actually, even from a psychological perspective, it weighs heavier on you than the error of omission. Mm-hmm. And then in our study, we also found it to be the bigger of the two problems. That's that indecision due to fear of failure. So the whole study then takes on how do we go about reducing the fear of messing up, right? How do we both help our teams avoid that instinct to jump into the fear of missing out, to drown them in FUD and more fear when a buyer's already terrified that they're going to make this decision and things are going to go wrong and they're going to get blamed. But then also in doing that, how can I reduce their fear that they're going to mess up, reduce the probability of a mess up for their buyers? And that's what Jolt is. That's the playbook for Jolt.
The concept of being a advisor to the buyer and playing an advisory role has been sort of around for a while, in which you are not like someone who is trying to get them to the dotted line and make them sign and make them pay, but somebody who is actually analyzing and helping them with relevant material and relevant stuff, right? So do you see that playing out in the analysis that you're doing? Because this view has been out there, right?
Yeah.
That one should change, morph into a trusted advisor.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the context as to where and in what proportion that individual is acting like a trusted advisor. Sure, like consultative selling, of course, has been around for decades, right? And I guess I would argue in service of what? So traditionally, I think the consultative process is still a different version of getting to the buyer to understand their need, to draw up their perspective on why that problem is so much worth solving and why it's worthy of your attention and why you should upend budget to go and solve this problem. I'm helping you along the way. The process of me doing so might be, you know, more Socratic in nature, and I might try to draw this out through questions, and I might, you know, but nonetheless, my job is to try to highlight that need, help them solve that need. You know, I'm a solver of problems. I'm not a salesperson, right? Okay, sure. But the point is, you're still trying to get them to understand the size of that problem and why it's worth solving. For us as researchers, we now understand that's a status quo problem. Right? It's absolutely necessary. I want to be very clear. You're not going to sell a darn thing to any buyer if they don't believe that their status quo is worth upending. Right? If you have not overcome indifference, you're not going to sell anything. But we now know that is necessary but insufficient. If that's all I'm doing and I'm not reducing indecision, I'm going to have a lot more stuck deals than I want. In our study, we found indecision actually is far more prominent than you might expect. So we found 87% of opportunities have either high or moderate levels of indecision. So sure, there are some buyers who are highly decisive. And if you want to just keep running your consultative, you know, playbook and keep running, you know, your discovery process and try to just sell that need, there are 13% of buyers who you can slam those suckers home. And you should, right? Keep doing that. The problem is there's not enough of them. 87% have some degree of indecision. And if all I'm doing is using that process as a way to drive home the need and sell the need, then you're going to end up with a lot more stuck decisions. It's still necessary, but insufficient. I have to pair that with the playbook to overcome indecision in order to get through to a decision for those buyers.
Right. So when you write about becoming a buyer's agent, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's a good point, right? So there's elements of having your customer's best interests in mind that are important for both playbooks, for both the status quo playbook and the indecision playbook. The act of being that sort of what we call buyer's agent in the book is a little different on how to overcome indecision. But there are still elements of just making sure the buyer understands that you have their best interests in mind, that you're most interested in helping them arrive, you know, at a decision. What's interesting about indecision often is these are situations where the buyer has clear intent to purchase. Now, that sounds like an obvious thing, but think about it from the buyer's perspective. Like, I see the problem, I want this thing, and I'm still stuck. Right? So like you have to unpack that from the buyer's perspective. In helping them pass indecision, you are actually helping them to solve the problem they already want to solve, and they can't on their own. But there's an element here about trust, and that doesn't really have to do with the seller themselves. It's really just about the nature of things between a buyer and seller. Because again, who among us has not been oversold or been overpromised in the past? So there's a little bit of a agency dilemma is the technical term for it that we have to overcome. The buyer assumes that the seller is incentivized to hide all the bad news, right? To hide all the skeletons in the closet, to not tell them about the reference customers that would give them a bad story and only point them to the reference customers that give them the good story, right? To oversell roadmap items that aren't quite ready for prime time, that there's all sorts of things that they assume isn't really fully true. And it's my job as seller or as buyer to make sure I understand all those things. There's some gap in believability about what they're saying it can do versus what it really will do. And so until I understand what that really is, I'm going to keep exploring. I'm going to keep kind of making sure that I understand all the crannies of this decision process. So a buyer's agent can be really useful if I'm able to earn back a little bit of trust. If I'm able to show them that, in fact, I do have their best interest in mind, that I'm not hiding anything in the closet. The closet's open. The light's on. You know, we're an open book here, and I'm going to show you that I know where this road's going. I've been down this road before, and we've done this in the past. And hopefully in that process, the buyer has a little bit of relief and they feel like they have a partner along the way, that they're not quite as alone in this process. And then they can trust that this person has done a little bit of the homework for me, that I don't have to do all this homework, you know, on my own. Doesn't mean it's an easy thing to do, but it's more that it's like, I'm going to share in this choice with you. Let's walk this walk together versus, I think the classic consultative, you know, sort of trusted advisor approach is, I have all this knowledge about what this, where you can go from a problem standpoint. So I'm going to help you get to that based on my knowledge. Again, necessary, but different in kind than what we're talking about here, which is, I need you to shift a little bit of the blame that you're worried about getting over to me. I'm going to take this and share this with you. Let's walk the walk together.
Ted, I have two questions quickly on this, okay? One is that, as you so well articulated, I think trust is a crucial component in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And we are sort of, the sales industry seems is under this pressure of crunching the time in which you can build trust.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a big problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you have seen in the study where this is happening. The second question, and I'm curious, I mean, what actually is happening here, in the sense that typically the entire market is chasing the 3, 5, 8% who is ready to buy today. That's where all the action is, mm-hmm. right? And very little is spoken about actually nurturing and building the relationship over a period of time and being part of that process where the customer realizes that need for a change and they go through the internal processes and they're so this whole journey bit is very little. In most sales approaches, mm-hmm. what do you see? Am I making sense? I mean,
yeah.
What did you see in your study? Are these people who are succeeding? Are they the ones who are also building relationship over a period of time, or are they also getting in at the same time as everybody else? Which means there is some kind of intent, some kind of signal that these guys are out there looking for something.
Yeah.
And they're then doing better than the rest.
I think there's some realities that you're speaking to in general about the world of sales and the world of buying now, and how early can we possibly get in, and how much time does that allow for us to actually to build this trust. And I don't know that a Jolt seller necessarily has figured out how to fix that whole dynamic entirely, right? What we can see as evidence is that when they do have interactions with buyers, they're doing different things that build a little bit of that trust and engender that even in relatively quick periods of time, you know, 30 to 60 minutes, you know, in those settings. Now, that doesn't mean it's fixed overnight. Right. And I can't tell you that just because you perform well on a call or that you indicate a certain things over several emails that fixes the entire process and that you're good to go from there. And sure, there's a whole series of dynamics that go into, you know, the information asymmetry, you know, and the dynamics that creates the purchasing power of a procurement organization and the places that forces you into, you know, the broken SDR channel and how that, you know, creates problems with kind of how you get to buyers. But you can see quite clearly is that Jolt sellers in those moments, there's a skill in the study we call owning the flow of information that indicates how they're interacting when they're with buyers. And there are ways you can earn back a little trust pretty quickly. One example, by the way, is telling the customer what they shouldn't buy versus what they should buy. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty counterintuitive for an incentive-based seller who gets more money when I sell more things. And so for the buyer, it's that much more powerful when they tell them, hey, this isn't right for you, or I'm going to take this out of the shopping cart. This is more of a year two thing for you. You're not quite ready for that. That's a trust-building thing that I can do, or giving credit to a competitor, another thing that you could do mm-hmm. that quickly. Again, not a panacea. Doesn't mean it's going to solve it overnight, but there are things that you can do to earn back a little bit of that trust, even in a short period of time.
Fair enough. I think that's great. Would you like to elaborate a bit about the chapter on what is the cost of indecision? I mean, how does the one talk about it and how does that impact the final?
Yeah, well, and maybe I could lay it a little bit more, the behaviors and skills too. I mean, look, the indecision, of course, I think is a problem everyone knows about. We've started to size the problem for organizations. 40 to 60% of decisions end in no decision. This is a dead weight loss. A lot of latent potential sitting in pipelines out there right now. If you could just upend and gain a little bit of progress on even 10, 15, 20%, think about the value that has for a given organization, not just because of the monetary value, but the time that they waste on all these opportunities where the buyer is spending months and months and months in evaluation only to decide to do nothing at all. The playbook that we found that makes a big difference here, the JOLT is an acronym. So it stands for the four key behaviors that we found that matter most for those sellers. The J is about judging the level of indecision. So I first need to understand the size and depth and breadth of indecision, both so that I can evaluate the quality of that opportunity. You know, are they ever going to make a decision at all? And if not, perhaps I should downgrade this, the potential of this deal. Maybe I should downgrade my forecast, you know, because they're never going to make a decision. But also I'll know a little bit more about the type of indecision they really struggle with. Because it turns out in the context of a purchase, there are kind of three big fears that a buyer has. And each one of the O, L, and T parts of the equation, or of the acronym, I should say, go to solve one of those three big fears. So the O, which is offer your recommendation, is particularly useful in situations where the buyer is stuck because they can't evaluate trade-offs, that there's all these options out there in the world that they need to make sense of. So even after they've decided, hey, I'm going to buy from you, there's a whole bunch of options and choices I look at and they all look right. Contract length, configuration, integrations, implementation, onboarding, all these different things I have to choose and they all look right. And I'm worried I'll make an irreversible choice and regret that immediately. So rather just wait. Firm and personal recommendation in that place where you essentially treat that person as if they were your best friend. If you were my best friend, here's what I would go and tell you to do. Most sellers, though, in that situation, run back to diagnosis. They use their sort of diagnosis skills as a way to defer to the buyer. Far be it from me to tell you what to do. Let's use the reason you started down this path as inspiration, and then we move forward from there. And all that does for the buyer is voice that decision right back on them at that moment. So firm and personal recommendation makes a difference there. Limiting the exploration is the L. This is the skill that's particularly powerful for the buyer who's stuck because they feel like they have to become the expert, right? They have to learn every piece of information. There's so much out there that it's my job to make sure I become that expert before I feel like I'm an informed purchaser. And so I'm going to make sure I cross every I or cross every T, dot every I along the way. And so the seller has to find ways to limit that exploration to healthy rather than excessive levels. You can't just tell the buyer, stop asking questions. So you've got to find ways to earn back a little trust. You've got to find ways to demonstrate that you've got this in hand, that you understand where this is going, and that you've done a little bit of the homework for them on their behalf. Bunch of techniques involved there. And then finally, taking risk off the table. This is the skill that's particularly useful for the buyer who feels like I'll be the one exception, right? Despite all the assurances you've given me, despite all the case studies and reference calls that I've done, I'll be the one exception, right? Other people get benefits. I believe that those people have great experiences, but we are unique. We are different and we stink at change. We mess things up all the time. We can't have nice things. We know this, right? And so they worry they're not going to get the benefits they're paying for. In this situation, the seller has to be very careful about setting clear expectations about what's practical and believable in these situations. And then they have to offer safety nets in certain situations. They have to de-risk this decision for this buyer, offer some protection for them in various ways. Now, we could talk about the different types of safety nets out there, but what's most critical for most B2B sellers is to offer something. To do something, because in B2B sales, most of us assume we're not permissioned or authorized to offer any sort of safety net. You know, we're not a retail store. There's no receipt. You can't walk in and return our thing. And so therefore, I just hope and pray that nothing happens. Like, I know that there's some indecision here. I get that there's some outcome uncertainty for this buyer, but perhaps, you know, I'll just throw a discount and hope that that's enough at that point. So they just don't do anything at all.
What do you see actually people doing from the research? What came out as two or three, I mean, maybe more, but what are the top sort of actions that people have taken, which have actually turned the tide?
Yeah, well, I mean, most critically, I think sellers executing those four key skills, and across a given sales force, there are going to be some people who are really good at offering recommendations, and there'll be other people really good at taking risk off the table, and there will be some variance there, even for some of the best Jolt sellers. I think there are some skills that we found that are going to require a little bit of practice, a little bit of repetition, a little bit of time to be able to master. But then there are some other ones that I think people can start doing tomorrow and get better at. And the two that pop out are the recommendation and expectation setting. You know, for me, there's a bunch of skill associated with getting better at that recommendation. So we talk about proactive guidance and advocacy and how you can place your personal stamp at it and get it improve over time. That's a skill we spend a lot of time working with people in our private courses on. But to oversimplify, if you were selling to your best friend, what would you tell them to go and do? Like in your gut, what's right? What's not? What are you well positioned for versus what you're not? What's a good fit versus what's not? What's a thing you can do well right now versus later? But sellers often get uncomfortable, you know, getting personal. That person might not be a friend of theirs, and yet they're still forced to have that personal conversation. And expectation setting is something that sounds obvious on its surface, but I can tell you through the data, it doesn't happen as often as people might think. And then even beyond that, it happens too late. So what we do is we wait for the buyer to set their own expectations, you know, about what they want to do and all the change they want to take on. And then if it starts to get too big, if their eyes get too big for their stomach, or we start to worry that maybe they're trying to take on too much, then we try to ratchet it back, because we start to worry. And so we do it too late, rather than being proactive and doing this as early as possible, grounding the buyer in practical and achievable outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at sales processes that most people are looking at, you know, there are these things like mutual action plans and stuff like that. They're all sort of guiding to the sale, not the outcome. So I think that's the big difference that I carry out. I mean, I take away from this, that you need to be concerned about the outcome that the customer is looking for and see how you can de-risk that bit for him, whatever that is. I mean,
yeah, and sometimes the perception of a potential mess up is bigger than the reality, right? So the buyer's imagination has run wild and they start to worry about all the things that could go wrong. And so there are things, we talk about mutual value plans or mutual action plans, maybe is a better way to think about it in this context, that, you know, are very common tools we use, to your point, as a way to help position the value and help them understand the ROIs that they're going to get from this deal. It's in that respect, more of a rational tool that I'm using as a way to appeal to the fact that there's a process in place and what have you. But done so in this context, it can be doubly useful as a way to at least demonstrate to the buyer that there's a plan in place, that we understand in day one, day 60, day 90, what's going to happen here. It's not always the way we think about using that type of tool. Now, that's useful in a place where it is more perception than reality. But there, of course, are times when the buyer is correct in saying that, hey, what we're about to do does have a lot of thorns on it. There are a lot of dependencies. There is a lot of variance in potential outcomes. And in those cases, you might actually have to take some real risk off the table. Absent that, you might not get a decision at all.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
How much of this is actually replicable as an idea? So you talk about building Jolt teams, right? So how much, like you did mention that some of these one can start off immediately, some of these need some learning and repetition. How replicable is this according to you?
Yeah.
And what size of teams would benefit most from this?
Look, I see teams of all sizes taking this on. This is something individual people can go and start doing on their own. Obviously, you know, from a behavior change, it's going to be most effective for a sales leader if you know you're approaching it writ large, you know, with your sales managers getting involved in coaching, and you're helping the teams understand those skills, you know, kind of at scale. But your first question was about the sort of the win potential or kind of the uptake potential. Look, I think the it is replicable for most people in different proportion, right? And the easiest way to think about it is early on, like take a couple of deals that you've got stalled and start applying these skills and try to upend and unstick those stalled deals and make some progress against them. But you know, there's definitely ways you can get better. You know, go to jolteffect.com and check out some of the tools we have there that I think can help to, you know, help managers coach towards these, help individuals understand what's going on in conversation, help them spot and recognize indecision. Sometimes even just knowing more about whether this is indecision or whether they're really indifferent still to you as the preferred supplier makes a big difference, because now I know a little bit more about the playbook I need to go and run.
Ted, thank you so much. This was lovely. I mean, I totally enjoyed, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book now that this is over, and
yeah.
I can go back and read it. And thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.